This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm delighted now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Diane Rehm. She's host of The Diane Rehm Show on WAMU in Washington, D.C., which is distributed by National Public Radio. The program has won many awards, including a Peabody Award and the National Humanities Medal. She's author of several books. The latest is a memoir, On My Own, which chronicles the death and life of her husband of 54 years, John Rehm. Welcome, Diane Rehm, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
So you write in this wonderful book about death and life and marriage and the fact that after a person is gone, we tend to remember the way they were in their good years. And indeed, your book is not only about death and grieving, but also about the long life that the two of you lived together. I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about your husband, John Rehm, and how the two of you met and got together.
Well, it always is for me a great story to tell because I was a secretary at the Department of State. John was an attorney working on international trade matters, and he was doing a fair amount of work for my boss on international trade. And, you know, he would come into our office fairly frequently, but I think it was really the very first time that he walked in that he saw on my desk three books. And the reason I recall those books is that he talked about them all the time. They were the Somerset Maugham's of Human Bondage, the essays of Alfred North Whitehead, and the Brothers Karamazov by Dostoevsky. And I think he was more than a little surprised to see those books on the desk of a secretary. What can I say? And so he started asking me questions about those books. He started, you know, we started up a conversation. I was playing softball for the women's team on second base. We were both playing softball, and we got to talking about softball, and we made a bet on the World Series that year, and I won the bet. So he took me out to dinner, and that was the beginning.
One of the things that was so striking to me as a woman of the generation that came after you is that your marriage and its evolution parallel a period of historical change for women in this country and really all over the world. I mean, you and your husband started out, as you write, in a kind of student-teacher relationship, with him being the very eager and sort of encyclopedic teacher and you being a student that was just drinking it all in. And then over time, as you became a journalist and radio host, those roles changed and you moved toward more equality. What was that like for each of you?
Well, I think for me, it was such an exciting time. You know, having been a homemaker for 14 years, having stayed here to raise my children, and to really learn to do new things in that period of time. I learned to play the piano, learned to sew, learned to cook, all those traditional things. But then when they were about, 13 and 10, I began to feel restless and realized, of course, that those kids were not going to be around for very much longer. They had already begun developing lives of their own. So I began thinking of how I was going to spend the rest of my life. And I began volunteering at this tiny little radio station, WAMU. And before you know it, had a part-time job there, and then did freelance work for the Associated Press and Physicians Radio Network, and then got this job 37 and a half years ago, or 36 and a half years ago. And my gosh, sure, our world's changed. I mean, here I was going off to work every day, and by the time I had a full-time job, my son was in college, my daughter was off at boarding school, so the children were not a problem. However, my relationship with my husband and his with me began to change in ways I think neither one of us had foreseen. I couldn't concentrate so exclusively on the home, on him, on what was happening just in his life. I was developing my own life. And yeah, I was part of that early revolution, and it feels very special.
And that revolution that made really my generation of women's lives possible to achieve without quite as much anxiety and quite as much struggle. Can you comment on what that shift was like for him? I mean, you write about it a little bit in your books.
I think it, certainly he was absolutely thrilled and overjoyed with my success and would brag on me all the time. Quietly, he would sometimes say, gee, you know, nobody irons shirts the way you do. And he missed that. That was just one tiny example of, for him, the fact that I was no longer there simply to be the supportive wife. I think also he was beginning, as he began to reach the end of his career, mine was still moving in an upward trend. And I think that that would have been hard for any man, or any woman, for that matter, in that position. But I think the fact that coincidentally, as John's career was beginning to wind down, he was not feeling as well, not feeling as strong, not feeling as capable. And I think that that made it even harder for him. About 5 years after he actually retired, he was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. And, of course, I write a great deal about that in the book.
We're talking to Diane Rehm about her memoir, On My Own. After the diagnosis, the two of you lived with his illness. He was retired, you were working, and there was the inevitable decline that comes along with Parkinson's disease. And at a certain point, the two of you agreed that he should go into an assisted living facility. It was an agreement that you both were fine with, and yet you write about a great guilt that you felt about it. Why was that?
Oh, I did, and I do. I mean, I think when you marry, when you take those vows of forever in sickness and in health. I mean, I did take those vows seriously. When the time came, however, when I could no longer take care of him, when he began falling, when I could no longer lift him, and when we had someone here with him during the day, but could not manage to have someone here with him during the night, and he began falling. It really was a choice. I mean, a choice I could not make. A choice to give up my work, to care for him for the rest of his life, to devote my entire life to the rest of whatever he had left. And instead, we both agreed that he should go into an assisted living facility. I think I'm forever going to feel guilty about that. At the same time, I really, really knew I wasn't ready to give up my work. I wasn't ready yet to step down. I wasn't ready to give it all up and be at home as a caretaker. I think, you know, some of us are really good at caretaking, and some of us are not. And I know that about myself. I know I'm not really a great caretaker. And I knew if I stayed home, I'd be resentful. I'd be angry. I would not really fulfill the need that John had at that time, which was to be lovingly taken care of. I just couldn't do it.
And that, the fact that you write so honestly about that, I think is really helpful probably for a lot of people, especially women reading the book, because women are so often expected. I mean, I think there's almost an unconscious expectation that we are naturally caregivers, that it's somehow in our DNA, and that's just not always true.
Absolutely not always true. And, you know, some young women, some older women decide wisely that motherhood is not for them. And I think that's a perfectly reasonable, rational choice. I had, however, made a vow, and that's why I ended up feeling so guilty. However, John really did get the best 24-hour care possible, something I alone could never have done.
You write in the book about the importance of talking about the difficult things, the pain, the regret, the rough parts in the relationship, and how important it is to do that while the other person is still with you.
Oh, boy.
And that's something that you could not do with your mother, who died when you were quite young, but you did with your husband. How did you come to have those important conversations with him?
I think we both realized that, and I think it took him longer than it took me, we both realized eventually that he was not ever coming back home. Several months after he began living at the assisted facility, he said something about exercising a lot so that he could build enough strength so that he could move back home. I didn't say anything in response to that because I really seriously doubted he ever would. I think he finally realized it, and we began talking about how much time we had wasted in our marriage, in sadness, in anger, in hostility, in being apart emotionally. And that was so wonderful to be able to talk with him about those things. As for my mother, as you said, she died when I was 19. And in that culture, you know, we did not ask those questions when we were young. I mean, I never asked my mother even how she came to meet and marry my father. I have no idea.
Yeah.
I didn't know what their problems were because I never saw any problems between them. They were just so totally together all the time and felt as though any difficulties they had, I think they simply kept from us, my sister and me. So we never saw a single argument between the two of them. That was the model I went into marriage with, but it sure didn't work out that way.
Both this book, On My Own, and your previous memoir, Finding My Voice, really give a great argument for the efficacy of psychotherapy. That is something that you spent some real time and attention in your life doing because of some of the difficulty of your childhood, because of some of the patterns that then reemerged in your marriage to John Rehm. And I have to say that there's something, even though I couldn't help wonder whether there was some ambivalence about revealing the things that you revealed and showing the parts that weren't so rosy, the fact that healing through psychotherapy was possible is kind of a beautiful and empowering thing.
Oh, my goodness. It really, really was. If I had not gone through all that therapy, and this morning I mentioned on the air that I also had several years of cognitive behavioral therapy, you know, I don't think I could have done the job I've done the work I've done, and gotten through the sadness of John's illness and ultimately his death. I don't think I could have, in as strong a way as I have managed, without that therapy. I think the therapy taught me so much, not only about myself, but how I reacted to the world around me, how my mind was in sort of patterns of thinking because of, as you well point out, my childhood and those ideas of mine that were embedded in me that then came out in my marriage. Now, the very same patterns emerged in John. His and my childhoods were so different. And the focus on education in his life, so, so different from that in my life. And that was one of the reasons he was able to become such a great teacher for me, and how open I was to that. And then that kind of changed as my work began and his work continued. We were more or less on an equal plane. But none of that could have been successfully maneuvered without psychotherapy.
How did you think about issues of privacy when you were writing about these things, which for so many people are very private, especially in the previous book when John was alive and you were writing about things that perhaps he might not want the world to know? Did you have those conversations before you let the book go into the world?
Oh, my goodness. I gave John the final draft, and I said, please read this, and if there is anything in here you don't want me to write, if there's anything in here that you do not wish to have revealed regarding our lives together or you in particular, please tell me. He read every single word and gave it back to me, and he said, it's just fine.
When your husband's illness had progressed to a point where he could no longer move around, he couldn't care for himself, he couldn't feed himself, go to the bathroom, a terrible, painful, sad stage of life, I'm sure, to live and also to witness, he then made the decision to die. But he was not allowed to get assistance in dying from his doctor because of the laws of the state. What were his choices then? What happened next?
Oh, it was so, so sad. Really so sad. First, we had a conference in his room, and the conference was with me, our son, our doctor, and our daughter, who is also a doctor, and she was on the telephone with us from Boston, where she practices. And John had asked us all to come together, and exactly as you've said, he said, I can no longer feed myself, I can no longer care for myself, I can no longer walk from here to the bathroom, I cannot even bathe myself. And then he said, I am ready to die. And, you know, even so, with the doctor sitting right there, it was clear he could not simply be put to sleep, which I think was his hope, his expectation. And the doctor said to him, the only way you can accomplish that, if that is your wish, is by refusing to take food or medication or water. And as you probably know, it's not a lack of food. You can exist a long time without a lack of food, but without water, the organs begin to give way fairly quickly. And the doctor said, if that's what you really, really want, that is how you can accomplish it. At which point, Jenny from Boston said, but Dad, we can keep you comfortable. And John Rehm said, I don't want comfort. I want to die. I am ready to die. And so we left the conversation without knowing his decision. And the next day when I came in, he looked so well. And he said, I have not had anything to eat or drink and no medications, and I feel great. And I think the reason he felt great was because he had actually taken his life back into his own hands.
Yeah.
And he died. That was on June 14th, 2014, that we had that conversation. And he died on June 23rd, 2014.
And that day was exactly 35 years after your husband had had a deeply religious experience that brought him toward the church after, I guess, a kind of more secular life to that date. Do you think that that would, I mean, yes, it's a coincidence and it's not a coincidence, but do you think that faith helped him at the end of his life?
Oh, I definitely do. And you know, when the doctor told him that it would take 10 days to 2 weeks, my son and I looked at each other and we both said June 23rd.
Oh my goodness.
We really knew. We really, really knew that he wanted to be with God again on that very same day.
Did that help you as well? I mean, did the whole question, you write a little bit about the question of whether there is heaven and an afterlife, and there's so many people who say when somebody you love dies, oh, they're in a better place now, and sometimes that's helpful, and sometimes it really, really isn't. But did that sense of your faith and his help you during this time?
I think it really did. I think the fact that John died on June 23rd was a beautiful, beautiful thing for him. I think that it was that day in his life. In 1979 was so incredibly important, where he walked into the Church of the Doubting Thomas in New York City and felt he was caught by Christ. June 23rd, 1979, and he dies on June 23rd, 2014. So there was really a coming together, I think, in his heart and in our minds, and perhaps in his mind as well. It was really extraordinary.
We're talking to Diane Rehm about her memoir, On My Own. At the same time, there was this other dimension that you and your family and he felt of kind of rage and helplessness about the fact of not being able to choose the end of one's life and not being able to die with dignity, but really having to, I mean, in his case, die of starvation and dehydration and the shutting down that comes with that. That has led you on a new trajectory in your own life. Tell us about that.
Well, I really do believe that each of us should have a choice in how we die. And what I mean by that is that there are many, many of us who believe in God and believe that it is God's will when we should go. And I believe that each of us who believes that should have that belief honored. There are others who believe that one should have all the palliative care that one wants, all the remedies, all the chemotherapy, all the radiation therapy, every treatment possible, and then live as long as possible with comfort care. And there are those of us, and I am in this last category, who believe that each of us should have a choice. And if I want to die because I have reached a particular point in my existence, when, like John, I can no longer care for myself, I am no longer, in my own eyes, contributing to this world in a positive way, when I can no longer feed myself or care for myself, I would wish to go. And that's what I am arguing for. Choice in dying, whatever the choice happens to be. And yes, I am in my book travels certainly talking about that right in which I so believe. I am also talking about God's will. I am also talking about palliative care, and I am urging people to talk with their families about what they want. So many people are currently in that sandwich generation where they may be caring for children and family, young family, and at the same time caring for parents, but have never had the conversation that begins, how would you like your end to be? What is it you see for yourself? What would you like me to do for you? How can I prepare myself in light of what you would like to have? Those conversations, I think, are among the most important families can have. And as our population ages, it's so important to know what your parent or your grandparent or your aunt or your good friend wants to have.
There's another dimension to this that I was thinking about when I was reading your book, because I mean, even with all the sadness and helplessness in the face of a terminal illness that you and your husband and your family were looking at, it's also true that you had wonderful resources and medical care. And as I was reading, I couldn't help but think of the many people who don't have that kind of care and how much more suffering there is for purely political and socioeconomic reasons. And I feel like part of this whole conversation is also the right to compassionate and competent medical care.
Absolutely. And of course, we do have more medical care available now to more individuals around the country. And that is thanks to President Obama and what he has done with the Affordable Care Act, which is obviously still under a great deal of discussion and argument and legal wrangling and so on. But nevertheless, you've got many, many more people now covered for medical care. Of course, Medicaid becomes the most difficult to get in some states because they opted out of the Affordable Care Act Medicaid provision. So it is the poorest among us who may be having the greatest difficulty getting the care they need, and that really is so sad.
What were some of the things that helped you deal with your grief and your loss after John died?
I think learning to be quiet, learning to be with myself, but of course friends. I mean, friends are so important. Friends and my children, my little dog. I mean, all those things, and my work most specifically. I think continuing to work has been a godsend because each day I'm thinking about new and different and important subjects and not just thinking about myself and my own grief. There is so much grief in this world that it makes my grief so infinitesimal in comparison to what's going on in this world. At the same time, individual grief is just that. It's individual. And I have to cope with my own grief, which, frankly, I don't think ever comes to closure. I think I will grieve for John for the rest of my life. I will think about him in very, very positive and loving terms. I will think about the life we had together in wonderful and loving terms, and how much he gave me in the way of support and understanding. And really, none of my career would ever have happened if I had not been free to volunteer while he was out working.
Right.
He worked to support our family for all those years while I was at home. And that is such a wonderful thing. 54 years of marriage when you begin in such different circumstances and then evolve into something totally different. It's quite wonderful when you think about it and look back on it.
How did you and when did you decide to write this book?
On that last night when John was dying, and I knew he was dying, that's why I was afraid to leave, I just put two chairs together and lay down on that with Maxie, my little dog, on my stomach and next to John's bed. And I couldn't sleep. I mean, nobody can sleep on two chairs. And so I got up. I had my iPad with me, and I just began writing what I was thinking, what I was feeling, what I was seeing, what I was experiencing. And I think that that really was the start of the book.
Did it help you, and did it help you through the grieving process to write it?
Well, writing is work. And I was working with a fantastic editor who has been my editor on all three of my books, our book being Toward Commitment, the one that John and I wrote together, Bob Gottlieb, who has been just absolutely wonderful. And I'd be on the phone with him almost daily. And he was just so helpful in asking questions and making me think harder and really writing, as I'm sure you know, is hard work, and working through the issues on the page was very different from just working through them in my mind. And that was, I would say, healing in some ways, very painful in others. But nevertheless, a kind of work that kept me going. So it was another element in the healing process, looking back, as well as having to look forward to realize that my life goes on and I have to make it worthwhile. And though I will miss John forever and keep him in my heart forever, as long as I remain on this planet, I have to keep doing something that is worthwhile. And that's what I hope to do.
After your husband died, you, of course, got lots of condolences, letters, and people speaking to you, and from listeners as well. Some of them probably beautiful, some of them awkward. Do you have any advice now, having been through this, about how to talk to somebody who's in grief, somebody who's recently lost a spouse?
I think the kindest, simplest thing to say is, I really am so sorry for your loss. And if there's anything I can do for you, if there are any errands I can run, if there is a need for grocery shopping, if there is anything at all, please let me know. And I think that's enough.
Yeah. So, Diane Rehm, you will be at WAMU hosting the Diane Rehm Show for the rest of this year.
That's right.
What are your plans after that, if you've made plans?
Well, I'll be at the station 3 days a week, helping them in various ways. I'll also be continuing to speak about my book and the right to die with dignity. I'll be continuing to perform in a play about Alzheimer's. We have plans to continue to take that around the country. I think I'll be busy, and that'll be just fine with me.
You came into public radio when it was really very young and very new, and it's changed a lot. What are your hopes for the future of radio, talk radio, particularly public radio?
That it makes sure to leave room for calm, good, incisive, thoughtful conversation on the important issues of the day. I think so much of radio has gone into rapid fire, make sure we move on to the next thing quickly, make sure we talk as fast as we can, make sure that we have lots of people arguing with each other. Well, that's not been my style, and I don't think people really, really learn from it. So I hope for public radio there remains that spot where people can have good, straightforward, understandable, thoughtful, good conversation. That's my hope for public radio.
Diane Rehm is host of The Diane Rehm Show on WAMU in Washington, D.C. It's distributed by National Public Radio. She's the author of several books. The latest is The Memoir on My Own. Diane Rehm, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
You're most welcome. Thank you. It was good to talk with you.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.